You're listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
Welcome to The Past Macabre, where we journey through history to uncover how our relationship with death reflects the values, fears, and hopes that shape the way people live. I'm your host, Stephanie Rice. Thank you for joining me for episode 27, Resurrected Funerary Spaces Within the Grand Egyptian Museum. As of November 1st, the Grand Egyptian Museum is finally fully open to the public. It took just a little over 20 years for the gym to be completed and open, finally, from the first time that construction started, which is honestly on brand for Egyptian monuments, considering the Great Pyramid took 20 years to be built as well. The Grand Egyptian Museum is huge. Its design is meant to evoke the look of the Great Pyramids, the look of all of the monuments across Egypt, but also still be modern and sleek looking. Honestly, I will be posting pictures on social media, obviously, but before then, if you don't get a chance to take a peek over there, I highly suggest just looking up the Grand Egyptian Museum. It's beautiful. And it is huge. There's over 100,000 items on display. That's just on display, not including what might be in storage in the collections. It would take many, 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 many episodes to get through all of that, which honestly, that could be its own podcast, just an audio tour of the Grand Egyptian Museum. But for this episode, we're just going to focus on some of the parts that are dedicated to recreating funerary spaces. Just three specific exhibits, actually. They aren't displays of mummies, though they're related to mummies, but we'll be exploring the digital recreation of Pnumhotep II's tomb and the complete assemblage of the treasures of Tutankhamun that were in his tomb for him to take to the afterlife, and Khufu's solar boats, which were meant to be his vessels for cosmic transcendence so he could join the solar god Ra. These resurrected funerary spaces aren't just these displays of death. They actually show us exactly what this podcast is all about, the way that people lived and what they believed in. So let's get started on our mini tour of the Grand Egyptian Museum. The first gallery we'll look at is actually all digital, and it's the digital tomb of Pnumhotep II. Pnumhotep II lived in the Middle Kingdom, which was around 1900 BCE, a little bit before and after. He lived a fairly full life. He was a nomarch, which was similar to a governor, provincial ruler. He ruled over just a specific area within Egypt and ultimately reported up to the pharaoh, for lack of a better phrase, as far as the political structure goes. And during this time period, there was basically a lot of active trade going on, a lot of goods coming through Egypt, and individual nomarchs were gaining a lot of money and power. So Pnumhotep II was one of those, and he had quite a lot of money for a very well-decorated tomb. His tomb is so well-known in the archaeological community because it's just got such high-quality craftsmanship. It's a rock-cut tomb, and as the tomb was being carved into the cliff face that it's in, pillars were left within the room. They're not necessary for actually stabilizing the room. They're just decorative, but they're completely part of the room as it was when it was still just a solid bit of rock. So it's very cool seeing this sort of craftsmanship and detail put into these sorts of things, these forever houses where people were going to stay for eternity. And the tomb paintings on these walls as well were very, very detailed and very vivid with lots of different colors. And they depict scenes that have given researchers all sorts of insights into life during this time period. One of the most famous scenes depicts visitors from Syria, Palestine, and it shows such details like their hairstyles and their clothing styles, and even the specific trade goods that they brought. And these types of details were rare to see depicted. Most of what's known about people from Syria, Palestine around the same time period comes from fragments found here and there within the archaeological record, but this kind of detail has been confirmed. For example, there's very colorful outfits that they're wearing, and that type of wool, and it's dyed a specific way so that whenever it's woven, it's got all sorts of different colors running through it. And that sort of detail was even preserved on this tomb. So it's very, very cool to see those sorts of things. And it also shows us what their relationship was with Egypt at the time, because they've had a very difficult and tense relationship at various periods throughout Egypt's history. So during some periods, they would be trade allies, and there would even be political marriages amongst the pharaoh's family and royal families within that Syria-Palestine region. And then other time periods, it would just be outright hostility and war between the two. So it's good to know whenever there are these different periods, we can identify them more closely based on tomb art like this. It shows actually such great detail. It even shows when the delegations were from neighboring countries that weren't on such good terms with Egypt, their delegation comes in with no weapons. But the delegation from Syria-Palestine is allowed to bring their weapons in when they're giving their offerings to Nuemhotep II. And so that goes to show that during this time period, their relationships, at the very least with this nomarch and this gnome, their trade relationships were very good during this period. Now, why the digital version of this tomb is actually so cool is because the tomb itself is in Beni Hassan, which is hundreds of miles south of Cairo. It's also a tomb that's gotten a lot of damage over time from lots and lots of visitors because it's been well known for over a century, if not longer, I think throughout most of antiquity, to be honest, and people were constantly coming in and out. Damage was being done to the beautiful wall reliefs and all of the tomb art. And this is actually what led to the documentation of all of the paintings that the digital recreation was based on. Thanks to one of the pioneering women in archaeology and the passion of a 17-year-old artist boy who his art skills and deep interest in ancient Egyptian artifacts would go on to change Egyptology in many, many ways. Howard Carter was trained by his father, who was a well-known artist of his time. And the story goes that on a visit to a mansion to the Amherst family, one of his father's clients, he saw their private collection of Egyptian artifacts and just fell in love. He would take his time there to document the artifacts and to practice painting. And the Baroness Amherst, who was also known as Mary Rothes Margaret Cecil, encouraged his artistic skill and his interest in Egyptian artifacts because she, too, was actually interested in studying Egypt as well. That's why they had her private collection. So she used her connections to actually get Howard Carter an apprenticeship as a tracer with the British organization that was working to document the tombs at Beni Hassan, because even during this period, the late 19th century, there was already a lot of damage and a lot of fading going on with all of the paintings here. Again, as the story goes, at the time, the most common way of documenting tomb art was to just put papers up on the wall, trace the outline of the art, take it back to England, where then the lines would be inked, and that was it. You'd get the very sterile black and white image that loses a lot, if not all, of the colorful details that were actually within the tomb paintings. Howard Carter was one of the first to actually make detailed and accurately colorful recreations. And specifically within the tomb of Neumhotep II, his actual paintings preserved so much that that's actually what all of the restoration work and this digital recreation was based off of. Within the digital recreation at the Grand Egyptian Museum, you get to see it as it is now. There's a projection on all of the walls, and you walk through. It's built basically like the tomb itself, but then the colors start to appear, and you get to see it in full color as it was when it was first painted. But then the best part, all of the scenes begin to come to life. Each of the scenes have been animated, which shows in a very cool way some of the ways that life in Egypt went on. For example, there's a marsh scene that shows the hieroglyphs around it fading away, and then Neumhotep comes to life, and it shows him using his throwing club to hunt waterfowl, and then in the next panel, he's spearing fish. So these were common depictions within tombs that actually did show what people did in their lives that they would continue doing in the afterlife in order to sustain them. So this is just a wonderful way to actually visualize those actions instead of just seeing a painting up on the wall. And speaking of that delegation from Syria-Palestine, in the animation, you can see them moving and they advance towards Neumhotep with their offerings, and they're bringing all of their livestock and animals with them. And so, again, it's very cool to just see all of these animations. I'll link videos in the show notes and social media. So it's thanks to Howard Carter that we actually have this digital recreation that everyone can see of Neumhotep's tomb and the beautiful colors of it. And it's also thanks to Howard Carter that we know of Tutankhamun's tomb and all of the wonderful artifacts that it held. And all of those artifacts are now finally back in Egypt and housed at the Grand Egyptian Museum. It's been 103 years since Howard Carter excavated the tomb of Tutankhamun, and that was the last time that all the artifacts from his tomb were together. Over the years, they got shipped to various museums and universities' collections for study and display, but now Egypt has them all back. All 5,600 plus artifacts are going to be on display. None of them are going to be in storage anymore. A lot of them have been restored, and the amazing conservation work that's been done on them actually allows us to see these artifacts in a better quality than Howard Carter did when he first opened the tomb. Researchers have learned so much about the original techniques and the original materials that are used that all of these artifacts that have been restored are still the original artifacts. They're restored in the same exact way they used to look. So don't worry, you're not going and seeing something that's just completely new or something that's just been painted over with modern paint. Everything there is going to be restored using the techniques and the materials that were used to make it in the first place. With every artifact on display, there will obviously be the famous artifacts like his funerary mask, his coffin, and the shrines that his coffin was nested in. But I want to highlight the portion of the exhibit that's dedicated to his lifestyle, more so than the very, very well-known artifacts of his afterlife. So this portion of the gallery, which is specifically labeled to highlight his lifestyle and the lifestyle of his family, it shows what he would have needed in the afterlife, which allows us to understand what was important to daily life. All of these normal everyday use artifacts were provided for the king so that he could continue to use him, because to the ancient Egyptians, the afterlife was an idyllic continuation of the current life. One of the things that King Tut especially needed during life was lots of canes and walking sticks. They were symbols of power to the pharaohs, so there's some that are purely symbolic, but a lot of these were actually functional for Tutankhamun because he could not walk without one. And even when he had it, he walked with lots of pain. He had a severe club foot, which led to a lot of vascular issues and even tissue death in his foot based on the forensic studies that have been done on his mummy. So even with these mobility aids, It would have been extremely painful for him when he walked. There's a lot of art that actually shows him holding the canes, using the canes, or he's in a seated position and his first wife, which we believe is actually his only wife, Anxunamun, is seen waiting on him a lot more often than is usually seen with other pharaohs and their royal wives. This has become one of the most famous depictions of disability in the ancient world so that people can study how people with disabilities were accommodated. And it's always very cool to see whenever we can actually see these mobility aids that Tutankhamun used in his life as well, and not just the paintings, which obviously are going to be more stylized, and still they're going to be showing him in peak physical form as far as what's considered the pharaoh's peak physical form. So there's not so many details on his foot or the varieties of canes that he had to use that we can learn from the physical ones that were put in his tomb. There are dozens of them that are now on display. So he had one for every possible occasion. There's also baskets and jars that were filled with food found in the tomb, and these are all on display. All of this food was intended to sustain Tutankhamun in the afterlife, and it also offers us a glimpse of what royal diets were like at the time. So it's not just local foods, and it's not the foods that commoners would have most often had access to. It's things like trade goods from grapes and wines that weren't typically grown in Egypt. They were imported during this period. And there's all sorts of fruits and vegetables and breads and meats that were preserved because of the dry, sandy conditions that they were buried under. There were also games and musical instruments included with Tutankhamun's burial goods. So truly, this offers every angle of what daily life would have been like for the boy king. There are dozens of sandals, articles of the everyday clothing that he would have worn, like your basic linens, but also many ceremonial outfits that have been carefully restored. So you can see how King Tut would have just dressed in his normal, everyday, non-official duties. And then you can see the lavish examples of the outfits that he would have worn during the specific religious festivals or whenever he was doing any sort of royal visits with dignitaries from other countries. And one of the coolest things, I mean, honestly, there's tons of cool things, but one of the coolest things is that in King Tut's tomb, there was a huge collection of model boats, and they depict all sorts of types of boats from his time, not just the like royal official sacred barges, like is most often just depicted in tombs. There's functional barges that were just your normal everyday cargo barges. And there's smaller papyrus boats that people would have used, like everyday people would have used for fishing. And then there's also the more elaborate boats that would have been used just by the pharaoh for normal excursions out on the water versus the ones that were more for like religious processions. So these types of models have actually helped researchers understand watercraft in a way that now that we've found more examples of shipwrecks and watercraft in the time since Tut's tomb was opened, we actually do know that these were fairly realistic depictions of the things that were actually in use during the New Kingdom, specifically the 18th dynasty that Tutankhamun was a part of. Some of the examples of the sacred barges that would have been used in very, very fancy processions along the water, or they would have just been used for like funeral ceremonial purposes, were what's called the solar barges. And those were exclusively seen as the ship that the sun god traveled on his nightly journey through the underworld so that the sun could rise again in the morning after it set at night. And the pharaoh was given these solar barges or solar boats as well in order to join on his journey, and they would eternally be with the sun god in the afterlife. And this is a tradition that actually dates back to the very, very old kingdom in Egypt. And the next gallery that we're going to take a look at is actually dedicated entirely to the two solar barges of Khufu, the builder of the Great Pyramid. These were found in large pits buried next to the Great Pyramid, so they were intended for Khufu to use in the afterlife. And now they're on a huge display with a huge building of their own that's dedicated to just them on the grounds of the Grand Egyptian Museum.
One of the solar barges has been fully reassembled, and each original plank was carefully restored and pieced back together. Honestly, conservationists who work on this scale impress me so, so much, because they have to have so much patience, and honestly, tons of skill, in order to deal with such delicate work for such a long period of time. One of the solar barges is actually still being restored by conservationists, and so with the way that the new museum is set up, the museum within the museum for the solar barges, is the conservation lab is fully on display as the conservationists are going to be restoring this slowly over time. So people get to see the process of conservation in action, which I think is very, very, very cool. It gives people a glimpse into how difficult and tedious this work is, but it's done in a way to make sure that everything is as accurate as possible. And this highly detailed research that's already been done on the wood of the first ship shows that these very large ships were actually seaworthy, or I guess riverworthy in this case for the Nile. They actually have water damage, I say in quotes. It wasn't actually damage, but there's evidence that they were in use in the water for at least a short period before burial with some like scraping. So they weren't just sitting there looking pretty. They were moving along the Nile. So it's possible that they were simply just used as part of the funeral procession for Khufu. It could have been that they were used for specific religious festivals before he died as well. But either way, before they were actually buried into the pits within the larger pyramid complex of Khufu near the Great Pyramid, they were very clearly in use. And that is very, very cool. The burial pits that the ships were actually found in can't really be visited by visitors, but they've recreated them in front of the building. So you actually walk into the burial pits, or this recreation of them, as you're entering the building in order to see the solar ships. And as you walk underneath, there's a bunch of stones above the walkway. And as you walk into that pit, those are actually the original blocking stones that were placed over the burial, the boat burials, in order to seal them for eternity. So because the builders originally assumed that nobody would ever see them again, there's actually still a bunch of the builders' marks underneath. So you can go and you can see what archaeologists refer to as graffiti, but these were marks specifically to let the builders know where these stones were supposed to go. Some of them have counts on them to show this was like, for example, brick number 300. I don't know if that's actually the number. I did not look too closely into what the marks were. I was just geeking out over the fact that they have them fully on display for people to see. It shows more of the human element that went into building the Great Pyramid and the entire pyramid complex. So it wasn't so much aliens or any sort of mystical anything. It's proof that normal humans with the same techniques and marks that we would use today in order to identify building materials were still used way back then. If you have a chance, I highly, highly recommend taking a trip to Egypt, saving up for one, going at any possible opportunity you can in order to explore the Grand Egyptian Museum. And I, as a nerd, would recommend spending actually a couple days for the museum so that you can really, really absorb all sorts of the details. Like, these are just three of the many, many, many examples. As I said, there's going to be over 100,000 artifacts on display at any given time. And that's just with as it is now. Most museums do eventually start doing temporary exhibits that will come through periodically on top of the exhibits that are currently just permanently on display. So it's a lot to see. I don't think anyone could take it in just one afternoon, unless you're basically speed running the museum. I definitely recommend spending as much time as possible to explore these more nuanced details of the way that we can learn about life in ancient Egypt through the things that they brought with them into the afterlife. So thanks for joining me at this look with what is three of many exhibits within the brand new Grand Egyptian Museum. And for the ancient Egyptians, it was very, very important to be remembered long after you were gone. To be completely forgotten to them was seen as like a second death. It meant that the ka of the deceased or the soul would disappear from the afterlife forever. And so the new Grand Egyptian Museum ensures that Nimhotep II and Tutankhamun, Khufu, and the many, many, many artifacts from others who are on display will be remembered forever. All of their names are going to be continue to be passed along through tens of thousands of visitors daily. I saw that within the first few days of the museum's opening, they were reporting that they had at minimum 18,000 visitors on any given day. So that is wild. So imagine being remembered by that many people throughout eternity. I think that that's very cool. And I can't think of a better way than this to honor the ancient Egyptians and their eternal afterlife wishes. In the next episode, I'll be sharing the fossil evidence that we have from archaeological excavations of dragons, griffins, and other mythical creatures. Sort of. Thanks for joining me again. Until next time.
Thanks for listening. Be sure to subscribe to keep up with new releases. Please leave a rating and a comment. That helps the show reach others who may be interested in the past macabre. For access to bonus content from all Archaeology Podcast Network shows, become a member at arcpodnet.com/members. That's arcpodnet.com/members. You can find show notes for this and other episodes at arcpodnet.com/TPM. And follow Past Macabre on Instagram. That's PAST_MACABRE. You'll find pictures of the sites and artifacts discussed, Q&A sessions, and episode topic votes. Hope to see you there.
The Archaeology Podcast Network is 10 years old this year. Our executive producer is Ashley Airy. Our social media coordinator is Matilda Siebrecht. And our chief editor is Rachel Roden. The Archaeology Podcast Network was co-founded by Chris Webster and Tristan Boyle in 2014 and is part of Cultural Media and DigTech LLC.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archpodnet.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.